Hey, roll up your pants. Here comes the colonel.
Okay. Enough of that. This is a serious show, I tell you, a serious program. Well, when we broke it the last half hour, we were talking to Peter Rubin. He's chairman of MR Technologies. That's May Rubin Technology Incorporated. And he was telling us about it. He calls get this right here, thermally driven refrigeration cycle, and harvesting energy directly from wasted heat. And we're trying to get our head around that, about, you know, not turning it into electricity, but for other applications. Also, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, we want to step on over here to the fountain of useless information we have here on the set for today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Okay, we're joined by the Spirit of the Fountain, I see, and I have the question for you, O Spirit of the Fountain. What Macedonian conqueror rode a horse named Bosephus? What Macedonian conqueror's horse was named Bosephus?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
I can't fool you, huh? What tipped you off? Macedonian? Well, the Macedonian conqueror who rode a horse named Bosephus, of course, was Alexander the Great. And all this time, our listeners thought Bosephus was the name of Hank Williams Jr., given to him by his father, Hank Williams Sr. All right, on with the show. Okay, we're going to get back in the line here with Peter Rubin. We've talked a lot on this program about harnessing wasted heat and using that energy that has just dissipated. And all of the methods that we've run into so far is taking that heat and turning it into electricity. There's plans to do that, as you heard, with Ray Bachman at the University of Texas at Dallas and others. Well, Peter Rubin, his firm has come up with a plan to harness the heat but not turn it into electricity. So that's what he left us at the last half hour. Let's pick it up from there. Oh, now, how do you use thermo energy directly without turning it first into electricity? You talking about heating a fluid or something, driving a pump or something? How does that work?
Well, let me talk about our approach, which is a classic approach called an ejector. Mm-hmm. We are a new type of ejector, but ejectors have been around for 100 years and have been doing refrigeration for nearly that long.
Okay.
You don't see many of them. Again, and I'll explain why, it comes back to the efficiency, but an ejector is like a T-intersection, where you have one slow-moving gas, the refrigerant, coming up into the intersection, like the smoke coming out of a smokestack. And imagine extremely high-speed wind taking that smoke as it comes out of that smokestack and blowing it, but it drives it into a funnel, so it in a sense compresses it.
Okay.
So it's another form of compression. The rest of the refrigeration cycle is the same. You have your evaporator, you have your condenser. It's just, how are you condensing that refrigerant gas? And in this case, it's thermal energy in a boiler somewhere is creating the steam, which is that primary drive that takes the other refrigerant gas and compresses it through the shear force, the shear turbulence. It's beautifully simple. It's nothing but an empty T compared to all of the pistons and valves and bearings, etc., of a mechanical compressor. So they're quiet, they're efficient. They're mechanically simple, but the efficiency is terrible. And a tenth, what that means of normal refrigeration on an air conditioning type of cycle. And what that means is you need 10 times as much energy to drive it. Well, that itself is not a problem if you're using waste heat. I mean, if you have excess heat somewhere and can use that and harness that, then the fact that it takes 10 times as much heat isn't so bad. But unfortunately, you need heat exchangers. You've got to get rid of that heat. And where the capital cost gets exorbitant is now, it's not just whatever heat you picked up in the room you're air conditioning. It's all this 10 times as much heat that was from your steam drive also has to be gotten rid of. So you need very large heat exchangers, very expensive, and they just don't make sense economically compared to electrical refrigeration. So the principle is simple, been around for a long time, but they're just too inefficient.
Okay, so when you make your presentation at the IEEE Energy Conference, who's going to be your audience, and what's the sort of the things that you're going to tell them about this?
Well, again, what we're going to be laying out is a design concept. It is in R&D now. We don't have the prototype, that we're working on that, but the concept is compelling, we believe, and we're pretty excited about it. And the concept has two components, two things that we think will give us a very high efficiency, higher than the world has accomplished so far in terms of thermal refrigeration. And one of the key elements is to recognize that in that system that we just talked about, that ejector system, you have two cycles. You have a refrigerant that is going through its refrigeration cycle and mm-hmm. being compressed by your driver gas. And then after the condenser, because usually these are water. Water's a pretty good refrigerant, and it's water that provides the steam. And after the condenser, it splits. Part of it goes on the refrigeration cycle to the evaporator. Part goes back to the boiler to be turned into steam. Two different cycles, but if you look back over history, almost all of them, at least always, they use the same fluid. The problem is they're two entirely opposing properties that ideally you'd like to have. If you look at the refrigerant, you want it to be a big sponge that soaks up a lot of heat, big phase change enthalpy. But as a dry fluid, you want it to turn into steam very easily. You want the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so what our application is about is using a binary fluid, one that has, it's a composite of two different fluids. And one is idealized and optimized to be the driver, so it has a very low phase change enthalpy and a very high molecular mass. So it's a good driver. And then the other is, say, water, can still use water. It's a very good refrigerant, has a high phase change, takes a lot of energy every time it changes state. And so these two mix in the ejector because the water comes back from the evaporator and is compressed by the jet of our candidate dry fluid.
Okay.
But then in the condenser, it's a fractionating condenser, and so they'll condense at separate points, and we will, instead of just splitting them arbitrarily, we'll capture the two different components and send the refrigerant back to the evaporator and the dry fluid back to the boiler. And so by doing this, we can optimize. And one candidate fluid we're looking at, for example, is a 3M product. And the amount of energy required to boil it is 10% compared to water. And yet it's a heavier molecular mass. It's a better driver. So imagine being able to have an electric motor that could drive your electric refrigeration compressor, and all of a sudden, magically, it only needed a tenth of the electrical energy to work. Your efficiency would increase tremendously. So we think that this optimization, this leverage from having two different chemicals optimized for two different cycles, will have a big impact.
Are you expecting then that this will take the place of our current heat pumps and air conditioning methods that we're currently using?
If we're successful in the second component, it will rival that. But let's come back to that question.
Okay.
Because a lot of it's going to depend on the source of available source of energy. In certain situations, absolutely, it will replace. But the other thing that's going to be critical to really obtain that kind of world-changing dynamic of rivaling and replacing electric compressors, we're going to have to be successful in doing something that no one else has been successful doing so far. And the binary fluid, that part, we really do know that there is an advantage to be gained there. That's kind of that part we're very comfortable with. What we want to do is move away from that sheer compression where you which is very inefficient, the wind blowing across the top of the smokestack, and move to another type of compression. It's called pressure wave exchange. And basically, it's like a turbine, only instead of using mechanical exchange with blades doing the compression, this will use pressure waves to do the compression. So there will not be a mechanical interface. Dr. Garris, at George Washington University, has been working on this through the 90s, mm-hmm. and has really been one of the leading proponents of advancing this concept and showing that it could even rival, in his mind, turbines. That it, between the inefficiency of ejectors and the efficiency of turbines, this notion of using pressure wave can bring you closer to the turbine and on the spectrum further from the ejector. So he has been working on various prototypes that involve high rotating nozzles, and has always run up against the problems of extreme speeds and rotation, bearing problems, thrust problems, and so on. So it's been not that the concept hasn't worked, but it's the implementation of the type of design he's run into some mechanical limitations in how to introduce it. We have another approach to it that we think solves or circumvents these problems. And if we're right, then we're going to be able to have an efficiency on the compression side that goes far beyond ejectors and is closer to mechanical compression. And we will also have the benefit of the binary fluid. And the two of those together could really, if they both are successful, they would be transformative.
Well, help me understand this now, because keep in mind, we've got a lot of different people in our audience, and I'm trying to figure out where the application for this science is going to be. You're still in the development stage. You're looking for investor money. And when you accomplish, and it seems feasible, and you're making it happen, but where are going to be the applications?
Okay, so that, right. I mean, so we've been talking technical aspects of it, but why does the world need this? I mean, it doesn't sound that sexy. It doesn't sound like cold fusion.
Yeah.
But an efficient thermal refrigeration cycle really would have a major impact. For example, we are surrounded by a vast amount of thermal resources that are largely untapped. Right. Waste heat. Over 55 to 60% of all of the energy consumed in the United States mm-hmm. is dissipated as waste heat.
Sure.
It's there to be tapped. Sometimes it is recaptured, but for the most part, the economics of collecting it aren't worthwhile. And part of the problem is that when you just have a heat exchanger, the temperature of that isn't increased. It's just captured even probably at a little bit lower temperature. Mm-hmm. And too much of that waste heat is low grade, low temperature. Too low a temperature to do really high-valued work like make electricity with a generator or run a refrigeration system. It's just slightly too low. And the same thing with solar. Solar thermal is all around us. We can capture it with collectors and warm our swimming pools or our bathtubs, but that's not real high-value work, and it's very hard to pay the cost of the collectors unless you're looking at a 10, 12-year frame.
Sure.
But if you can take, if we could harness that low grade and upgrade it to a higher grade, economically upgrade it, then all of a sudden we can do useful work with clean energy that is a great supply, in great supply. And to do that useful work, we have to raise the temperature. And a refrigeration system or a heat pump does that.
Okay, so you're comparing this to a heat pump, and we have heat pumps already. What you're talking about is improvement on an existing science. Is that correct?
I'm talking about the economics of the heat pump. More than the improvement of science, it's the economics that we do have heat pumps. They're basically electrical heat pumps. And there are situations where it does make sense, and they are used in some geothermal home heating, etc., where they drive an electrical heat pump to take a thermal heat source and raise its temperature. But you got to remember, go back to that rule of three. You're going to squander 3 watts of very high-grade heat energy to create 1 watt of electricity. So that 1 watt of electricity, it better upgrade a whole lot of heat, or you're going backwards. And so, unfortunately, in most situations, it is not economic to see heat pumps capturing and upgrading waste heat. But if you can use the waste heat itself as a source for driving your refrigeration cycle, and even if you need to top it up a bit with a little natural gas combustion, whatever, but the main thing is if we can shift the source and change the economics of the energy driving that heat pump, then all of a sudden it can make sense across a much wider application to be able to upgrade waste heat for use in process heat and use to make electricity, for use in refrigeration. These are all valuable opportunities and can justify the capital investment. And I'm going to talk about one example of perhaps one of the most valuable ones.
Okay.
And this is, if we just did nothing else but concentrate on this one,
all right,
it will have a major impact on the world, and that is distillation and desalinization.
Oh, okay.
There have been, for a long time, thermal desalinization and distillation units.
Sure.
They're made by General Electric and Siemens, and they use a refrigeration cycle to reduce the amount of energy required to evaporate the water. And so your heat on the condenser side evaporates the water, and then you take this warm vapor over the chiller plates on the evaporator side.
Sure.
And you do two things. Number one, you condense it back into pure water, mm-hmm. and you steal the heat back out of it, which is returned through the compressor over to the hot side.
Yeah,
so you can recapture and reuse up to 95% of that heat of evaporation. But on a large scale, to really, when you're talking about water, there's so much energy required that even that 5% becomes very expensive. And in fact, is more expensive than reverse osmosis. And so today, that's why the majority of new plants are RO, not thermal. It's about, if you look out in the world today, it's 50-50, but of the new plants, there are 80% of them are RO and 20% are thermal. But those thermal plants that use that vapor compression, it's mechanical. It's electrical mechanical. It takes electrical energy.
Mm-hmm.
If we are able to harness, let's say we build our desalinization plant right beside a big electrical generation plant, power plant,
okay,
which throws off tons of, I mean, huge amounts of
heat,
energy,
yeah,
of
yeah.
Waste heat.
Sure.
And if we use that waste heat as the drive source to desalinate, then we're talking capital costs, but we're not talking energy costs,
uh-huh.
other than the energy required for pumping the water through the plant and so on. And that we're also incidentally working on a thermally driven liquid pump to try and take our energy costs right down to near zero. But that notion of desalinization is very important for the United States, and we're not talking coastal areas. Over the next decade, there's dozens of cities inland in the United States that are depleting their aquifers. And as the aquifers are drawn up, beneath them they're bringing up brine. And that brine level is beginning to hit, or you will see it over the next decade for a number of cities, hit the town pipes. And pretty soon you're going to have inland towns and cities requiring desalinization or looking for new sources of fresh water, competing with each other. The need for inland desalinization is going to become a reality. And these plants are very expensive, and the cost of operation and making water is very expensive. But one thing we can do, if they all have power plants nearby, if we can harness that, we can make a difference.
You make some good points there, and of course desalinization is an important subject not just in the United States but all over the world. In fact, as I understand, Israel is doing some pretty dramatic things with desalinization. Are you working at all with any Israeli concerns?
There is an Israeli company that we do want to talk to about joint venture, but our belief is that we would prefer to complete our prototype and then get into negotiations. It's really a question of creating the value for our company before we enter into kind of commercial negotiations.
Now, Peter, you told me that that Wayne May is really the scientist behind this technology, and you're the businessman. And how long will it be that you're going to have a real working prototype that can go commercial on this?
I'd love to say tomorrow, but the reality is we're probably at least a year of modeling and initial prototyping, followed by another year of optimization. So in 2 years out, we should be at the more of the creating the commercial and doing the pilot plant testing. The key opportunities are capturing waste heat and solar heat and making them usable, and then a primary example of what it could do is the desalinization and distillation. So I think we've got the thrust of what this means, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
What would be one real succinct piece of wisdom you can leave with?
I would. It's a piece of wisdom that I have trouble following myself, and so I'm always reminding myself, and it is to try and stay focused. And for BFE, what that means, we have a range of opportunities. Many we haven't even talked about, but we've got to pick one, burrow in on that, make sure that commercial application represents low-hanging fruit. And for us, it would be replacing absorption chillers. Anywhere that an absorption chiller is used today, we can be more efficient at a fraction of the capital cost and a small piece of the footprint. So that is a market that we will go after and begin with. And so from the invention side and the creation side, you get excited when you stand on the mountaintop and see this whole range of opportunities. But we've got to bring it back and make it a reality with one business step at a time.
Well, that's pretty fascinating stuff. I hope you'll keep us informed about what's going on with this, because we're real interested in this subject and have been, you know, for a good long time. So please keep us updated on what's going on with your research and everything like that, and wish you all the luck in the world, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's our pleasure, and we're happy to share it, because it's something that we believe pretty passionately in, not just from the commercial side, but also because of the importance that this would have if we are successful.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
The electric utility industry in general is a very fascinating industry. It seems old school, but it's not. There's tremendous new technologies, whether it's superconductors or power electronics or, you know, smart grid and communications and so forth. And it's an industry that has, I think, very good employment opportunities moving forward, and should be an area that the youth of today shouldn't necessarily ignore, and always just look at computers and software as the way to look at their investment of their intellectual capital. I've been in this side of the industry for somewhere between 25 and 30 years, and I've just had an absolute blast, and I think anybody else in this industry would say the same thing. Jack McCall, Director of Business Development for Transmission and Distribution Superconductor Product for American Superconductor.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.